All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer in the United States Army in 1969 when I got to tour the beautiful area of Southeast Asia. I want to welcome you to our program today. We've got some interesting guests. We're going to be talking with the executive director of the Soldiers Memorial Military Museum in St. Louis, Missouri. And we're also going to be talking to a Vietnam-era nurse. Edie Meeks is going to be on in the second half of the program. And she's going to be talking about her journey to and from Vietnam, where she was a nurse at the Saigon, I think it was a third field hospital, and then she eventually ended up in Pleiku. And she's got a great story. I met Edie the first time at the Fisher House Stories of Service program that was held back in November. So I want you to make sure that you stay tuned for her story. It's going to grab your heart. She talks about her boys. And we're also going to talk a little bit about George H.W. Bush today. As we heard on the news, he passed away on Friday. And I've got some information that I want to share with you, some articles that were sent to us. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, we're going to be doing that in about 15 minutes or so. Please feel free to give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Or you can call us toll-free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. I would be remiss if I don't remind everybody that Veterans Radio is brought to you every week by our good friends at Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans, fighting for veterans' rights, concentrating only on veterans' disability claims. Also, we're sponsored by American House, senior living community in Westland, Michigan, located at 1660 South Fenoy Road. And for more information on the American House in Westland, you can give them a call at 734-961-4782. The American House on Vinoy is a full-service assisted living for our seniors. Also offers memory care and also hospice. And they have a special deal going for veterans. So if you want to give them a call, please do. Their number is 734-961-4782. And also, we've been fortunate here in the local area to pick up the sponsorship of all three of our local veterans organizations. Number one is the Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310 of the Vietnam Veterans of America, the Graft O'Hara Post 423 of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and just recently, the Erwin Prescorn Post number 46 of the American Legion, all from Ann Arbor. And we want to thank all of these organizations for their continuing support of Veterans Radio, because without you, we wouldn't be able to do this program. So thank you very much. I'm going to bring on our first guest right now. Excuse me. And that is Mark Sutliff. And he's an Air Force veteran, and he's the new director of the Soldiers Memorial Military Museum in St. Louis, Missouri. Mark, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the time and look forward to talking with you.
Well, I'm pretty excited about this. I have a sister who lives out in Arkansas, and every time we drive down there, we go through St. Louis. And so now I have another reason to stop off and visit.
Oh, beautiful. Wonderful. That'd be great.
So tell me all about the Soldiers Memorial Military Museum. It's just been reopened.
Yeah, correct. So it was it was planned and originally opened in 1938 as a tribute to World War One men and women who gave their lives, those from St. Louis. This was a memorial built in 1938 for that World War One folks. It started that way, and then it was owned and operated by the city up until about 2015, so almost 80 years. And then the city entered into an operating agreement with our organization, which is the Missouri Historical Society. So the Missouri Historical Society now operates the Soldiers Memorial, but it's still owned and owned by the city of St. Louis. So it's a pretty cool partnership between a government, you know, it's a public-private partnership. It's working really well. But we were able, the big thing that's happened in the last 3 years is we put it through a $30 million renovation, which was enabled by the Taylor Family Foundation. And that that Taylor Family Foundation is actually is part of the Enterprise Car Company, and the founder of that, Jack Taylor served on the USS Enterprise during World War II, and then founded his car rental company after the war. And now that it does great philanthropic work in the St. Louis area. So
there's something I'll bet our listeners didn't know. That's where Enterprise cars came from. Yep. All right, that's kind of cool. So tell me about some of the upgrades. I was really your website is great. It's mohistory.org for our listeners out there. That's mohistory.org/memorial, and it talks all about the upgrades that you've done. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah, it was really a top-to-bottom upgrade. They're kind of concentrated in a number of – I kind of lumped the things into a number of different areas. One of them was accessibility. There were a lot of issues with the building that it made it very difficult if you were in a wheelchair or otherwise had some movement disabilities to get around the building. You know, it was built in 1938, and the standards were just quite a bit different then. And, in fact, with the passing of – George H.W. Bush, we're reminded that he was the president that signed in the ADA law that brought buildings into compliance and to make them more accessible.
Right.
So that was a big focus of was the restoration, was to get the building more accessible. There was a ramp that was added to the building some time ago that enabled wheelchairs. The problem was the ramp was put onto what we generally considered the backside of the building, and meeting with veterans who were working with us on an accessibility committee, you know, the fact that a disabled veteran had to enter the building basically from the backside was completely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the renovation was to add an additional ramp that now they enter the building through the front door, which we thought was much more appropriate and respectful. So a number of things associated with that type of accessibility features. But then other things were just bringing the building from 1938 up to 2018. The building had never had air conditioning, so that
and
was
that's
added.
That's in St. Louis.
Yeah, that's in hot and humid St. Louis.
Yes.
It's quite difficult to imagine this building not being having any air conditioning,
wow.
But that was the case. So, and then lots of other infrastructure changes and improvements as well. And then, of course, the exhibit end or the museum end of it was another huge aspect of the renovation, and that was completely removing all the artifacts that were on exhibit, getting them properly stored, conserved, cared for, and then basically redoing the entire exhibits. And they're quite stunning, and they're a real tribute to the men and women who have served from the St. Louis area.
So this is not this is not just for World War One, the World War One stories. This is going back and telling a story of all the veterans from St. Louis all the way back to the Revolution. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So the exhibits start with the Revolutionary War and then come all the way up through today. So Operation Enduring Freedom. And it's really telling the role that men and women have played in the service primarily, but then also how communities have been involved with conflicts and through in service as well. So, but yeah, it covers the entire span of history in that sense. But yeah, the memorial started out as a World War One memorial. That was in 38, and then in 48 they actually added what's called the Court of Honor. That's a nice kind of park memorial across the street, and that was a memorial to World War II men and women. And then since then they have added a Vietnam memorial to that area, as well as a Korean War memorial. So there's the memorial aspect, but then there's also the museum aspect of Soldiers Memorial, and the museum aspect covers, like you said, Revolutionary War all the way through today. So.
Right. Well, when I was researching this, I was reading an article from looks like the St. Louis. What paper is this one? St. Louis Post Dispatch. That's
sure.
The one. Just to remind our audience here that we're talking with Mark Sunloff, right? Is that correct?
Correct. Yep,
okay, good. And here, an Air Force veteran and is the director of the Soldiers Memorial Military Museum in St. Louis, Missouri, and they've just reopened, was it around Veterans Day, wasn't it?
Yes, yep, on November 3rd, so just the week before Veterans Day.
But one of the things that I found in the article that I thought was very cool is that you actually have a studio built into it so that you can do your Veterans History Project there of recording the veterans' stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, part of the exhibit development, what we really wanted the exhibits to do was to tell the story of, you know, I don't like this phrase, but, you know, the average service member, you know, the So it's not all about the big generals and the big battles, but it's about the frontline individuals, so to speak. We wanted to make sure that their stories really shined through and were heard and were seen in the exhibit. So we incorporated a number of components to have audio and video display of oral history recordings that we've done. And like you said, we want to continue that effort. And part of the facility, we've included a room which will be dedicated to collecting oral histories of veterans and making sure that those continue to find their way into the exhibit space as well.
I think that's great because, that's what we like to try and do here on Veterans Radio is to get as many stories as we can and get them out. So I want to make sure that our audience is aware that there are facilities like this, and I know that we have listeners from the St. Louis area that tune into Veterans Radio, so I'm encouraging them to go on down to your Soldiers Memorial Museum and record their stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, those stories are so critical, and as you know, Dale, I'm sure, you know, most veterans, you know, they start those interviews and they say, well, I don't have anything to contribute or
right.
so modest, you know, and then you actually start to talk to them and you discover these incredible stories of service. And so, yeah, we want to do our part in trying to collect those and then more importantly, share them and get those stories out so people are aware.
So when is the museum open?
We are open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We'll be closed on Christmas and Thanksgiving, but other than that, we're open every day of the year.
So. Do you have ongoing programs there like some of the other museums around the country do?
We do, yep. In fact, I just stepped out of a program. We just finished a talk, a public talk about the restoration of the building, so to try to get a little better explanation so people understood what the building has been through in the last 3 years. And then next weekend, our curator of military and firearms will be giving a guided tour of the World War I exhibit here.
Okay. That'd be great. Yeah, because I was just looking at, it looks like December 4th is going to be a pretty busy day for you. We've got, it's sold out, it says. St. Louis and the Great War member tour. I guess this is for members mostly. But
Yeah. Yep, that's another member tour, but yeah, they will be doing, you know, guided tours like that continually, so there'll be more opportunities for sure.
Okay. Is there a fee to go to the museum?
There is not. It's free. Yep.
Oh, that's the best part. What about if I want to become a member of the museum?
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to become a member, go to a good place to start would be that mohistory.org and you can find the membership information there. Sure.
Okay, I see it. I'm clicking on it right now. Joiner to review. Well, I think this is great. It sounds like you've got a great project going on there in St. Louis, Missouri. It is the Missouri Historical Museum, Soldiers Memorial Military Museum. Is sponsored by or run by the Missouri Historical Society. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, but still owned by the city. Got you covered
correct.
There.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for being on Veterans Radio, and I'm looking forward to stopping by the next time I'm in St. Louis.
All right. Thank you, sir. Please let me know when you show up. I'd love to meet you.
Okay. Yeah, me too. Thank you very much,
right.
Mark.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about George H.W. Bush, his experiences in the military, and also as president. So stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one mortar gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we want to pay a little homage to former President George Herbert Walker Bush, And I want to read you a citation that I found. He received the Distinguished Flying Cross, in case you weren't aware of that. So let me see this. It says, United States Pacific Fleet Commander, 2nd Carrier Task Force Pacific Fleet. In the name of the President of the United States, the Commander, 2nd Carrier Task Force United States Pacific Fleet, presents the Distinguished Flying Cross to Lieutenant J.G. George Herbert Walker Bush, United States Naval Reserve, for services as set forth in the following citation. For distinguishing himself by heroism and extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flights in line of his profession as pilot of a torpedo plane during the attacks by United States naval forces against Japanese installations in the vicinity of the Bonine Station. Opposed by intense anti-aircraft fire, his plane was hit and set afire. As he commenced his dive, in spite of smoke and flames from the fire in his plane, he continued in his dive and scored damaging bomb hits on the radio station. Before bailing out of his plane, his courage and complete disregard for his own service, both in pressing home his attack in the face of intense and accurate anti-aircraft fire, and in continuing in his dive on the target after being hit and his plane on fire, were at all times in keeping of the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service, signed by John S. McCain, Vice Admiral, United States Navy. How's that? That's a little ironic, isn't it? So George Herbert Walker Bush passed away on Friday. And many of us know him as, Bush 41. And one of the things that occurred, and I've been going through all these different articles that came out over the last couple of days, and one of them really that I found interesting, and I'm going to give full credit to this, is from Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press. And he says, understanding George H.W. Bush, a letter at a time. It seems that last year that Mitch, has been on these book tours, it seems like forever, but he said he flashed back to a trip to Houston last year where he had to make a speech. And upon arrival, he was in his hotel suite for a couple of hours, and there was a book on the table called All the Best by George Bush, a collection of letters from his life as the 41st President of the United States. And he goes, oh, right, Houston, Bush, hotel. Yeah, there's a connection right there. And so anyway, he started reading it, and we all know the historical part of it a little bit, I guess, that President Bush, the 41, was vice president under Ronald Reagan. He had also been the United Nations delegate ambassador. He was the ambassador to China, and he was vice president. He was also head of the CIA for a while. So he was very, very, very well trained, I guess you could say, in his experience levels to become president. But he said he had very little idea about who President was, President Bush was as a man. And so he's reading these letters that he wrote to his parents. And in response to the Distinguished Flying Cross, the two crewmen on the plane that he was flying were never seen again. And so it's, you can only imagine that. So it said the early pages of this book were devoted to his letters from World War II, many of them to his parents. It's important to remember that George Bush enlisted at 18 years old. Actually, he was 17 when he attempted to get into the Army Air Corps initially. He had gone to Andover Prep School. I mean, the Bushes they had some money. They were a historical family. They'd been in politics for a long time. His father had been a senator himself. But when he graduated from high school at Andover, he wanted to go straight into the service. Now, he wrote that he could have gotten out of it probably because his dad could have pulled some strings and said, why don't we get you into college right away, or let's give you a job, that's necessary and so forth. But George Herbert Walker Bush said no. He wanted to be in the Army Air Corps, and he wanted to fly airplanes. And so, over the objections of his parents, he enlisted. And at 18, it turns out that he was probably, once he got his wings, he was probably the youngest pilot in the United States Army Air Corps, amazing, just amazing to me. And these are things that we don't know about these people. As a matter of fact, George Herbert Walker Bush is the last president to ever have served in the military during combat, and the last, of course, of the World War II Greatest Generation. So anyway, back to Mitch's column. So George H.W. Bush wrote this letter after being shot down where two of his crewmen died and when the plane filled with smoke and he had to eject. He said, as I left the plane, my head struck the tail. I now have a cut head and a bruised eye, but it's far from serious. After jumping, I must have pulled the ripcord too soon as I was floating down, and I looked up at the canopy and several of the panels were all ripped out. Just as I got floating down, I saw the plane hit the water. Another nice little story about this is that his plane was named Barbara. It was written right along on the side of the airplane. So if you know about the 73-year marriage between George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara Bush, he was in love with her, from says in the story, from the first time he ever saw her. So there was also a letter that he wrote to the parents of one of his fellow soldiers who had gone missing. I wish I could tell you exactly what happened to Jim, but I do not know, nor does anyone. I'm afraid he just never returned from a search flight. It is entirely possible that at this very minute he's on some island. I know how hard it must be for you to keep your spirits up, but all of us must keep saying to ourselves that Jim is still alive. Let's just keep that ray of hope in our hearts and in our prayers, and perhaps our faith will be rewarded. Unfortunately, the Jim was never found. Mitch goes on to say, I thought about how hard it must have been for Bush to write this letter because he was only in his early 20s. And I thought about Bush as the president, the last president to have served in World War II, and in fact, as I mentioned before, the last president who'd ever seen action in any war. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump never had any military service at all. So as he realized, he didn't realize how much he knew about this president. And the book continued with letters of his courtship to his wife, Barbara, and one love letter he said is, I love you, precious, with all my heart, and to know that you love me means my life. How often I have thought about the immeasurable joy that it will be ours someday. How lucky our children will be to have a mother like you. And there were many more letters like this. Mitch is in the column. He says, I'm not scrubbing to clean the legacy of our 41st president. He had, enough issues, as it said. So when he was reading on Saturday morning that he had died, here he served in Congress. He lost two races for the Senate. He had been at the United Nations, the CIA, and, of course, the White House, and possibly the youngest fighter pilot in the United States Navy during World War II. And at the age of 90, he celebrated his birthday by skydiving, which he did at 85, 80, and 75. I wish I had the courage to do that. It sounds like it'd be something really kind of fun to try. But in his inaugural address, he said, there's a quote here that I want to read to you. It said, and I think this is so important in today's world, it says, America is never wholly herself unless she is engaged in high moral principle. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world. Mitch says, I, like you, perhaps miss that kind of thoughtfulness, decorum, insight, and language. After reading Bush's letters and realize that presidents are rarely appreciated while they serve, but if their actions are honest and their intent noble, history will serve them well. And Bush's were, and we hope that he rests in peace. The other article I've wanted to read to you real quickly, I think I've got 3 minutes. Thank you, Derek. All right, so it's this is from the Houston Chronicle. Its last words, his last day, it says, started with three eggs and ended with, I love you. Began the last day of his life with three eggs for breakfast and ended it by telling his son, George W. Bush, that he loved him. James Baker, a close friend who served as Secretary of State under 41, told CNN State of the Union that he stopped by Bush's home on Friday morning and that Bush woke up and ate a big breakfast. And he says, hey, Bake, where are we going today? And I said, well, Jeff, we're going to heaven. Baker recounted, and Bush said, good, that's where I want to go. He'd been bedridden for several days and had been struggling to speak, Baker said, but Bush appeared more alert than usual, and we all began to think, well, here we are. He's going to surprise us again. It's another bounce-back day. Well, unfortunately, it was not a bounce-back day. It said he had weakened greatly, and he spent the last hours with the family talking to his children on the phone and saying his final goodbyes. It says that the last words he ever spoke was talking to George W. Bush, 43, and it says, and I love you too. And those are the last words. I think this is a man that we should look at, historically speaking. He carried out his office with honor, distinction. Maybe one of the last Boy Scouts. I don't know. It seems that way. But it is sad to say when the generation of that, you know, that World War II generation is passing by, and this is just another great American hero who is gone. So let's look back at the history of George Herbert Walker Bush and just say a prayer for him and for his family. There was a cartoon, an editorial cartoon, that had him landing his torpedo plane up in heaven with his wife and his daughter, who had passed, you know, preceded him in death, waiting for him. He says, "Here I am." So we'll be back in just a little bit with our next guest, Edie Meeks, a nurse in Vietnam. Stay tuned for the news. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Back on Veterans Radio, and that was a song that I found on an album that was sent to me called In Country, Folk Songs Written by Americans in the Vietnam War, Performed by Americans. And I thought that was kind of appropriate for our guest right now, who is hopefully on the line, and that is Edie Meeks, U.S. Army nurse, retired. Right, Edie?
Right, retired.
Well, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio. I've been anxious to talk to you since I had the opportunity of meeting you at the Fisher House presentation.
That was amazing.
Wasn't
the event
it?
Was just amazing, yep.
I know. I can't wait to get the rest of the people that talk there on the program, too.
Yeah. Everyone was special, and each of their stories was unique.
Absolutely. And the idea of your story, I found, just grabbed my heart. So let's get right into it. You joined the Army Nurse Corps in early 1968, correct?
Correct, in February 1968.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So had you already finished nursing school?
Yes, and I had worked for about a year and a half before, and then I was in California with my brother, and he was drafted, but he decided to join the Marine Corps. And I didn't know if the war was right or wrong, but I knew that if something happened to him, I'd like someone there who wanted to be there to take care of him. So I joined the Army Nurse Corps.
and he said,
well, that's wonderful, E, but the Navy takes care of the Marines. And I think he was really relieved that I wouldn't be there.
That was true. Leave my little brother alone, right?
That's right. That's right. Yep.
All right, so you ended up going through the Army nursing training program. Can you describe that a little bit for our audience?
Actually, I didn't go through the Army nursing. Well, I went through basic training.
Yes.
But at that time, they had a program where they would pay you for your last 2 years of nursing school, and then you owed them 3 years in the service.
Okay.
But I didn't do that. I had been out and then joined. And then we went to basic training, where we learned how to do tracheotomies and cut downs and what Agent Orange was, at least what they told us it was at the time, and just how to cope with the Army.
which is a challenge in itself.
Yes, quite true.
All right, so you ended up going over to Vietnam in July of 1968, and where were you stationed?
I was stationed at Third Field Hospital in Saigon in the intensive care unit.
Ooh, wow. Could you describe what your duties were there?
Well, we had one half of the area that we had was the recovery room. They would come right out of surgery and we'd stabilize them and then move them over into the intensive care unit. And we actually just tried to stabilize them enough to send them to Japan. We received the same patients everybody else did because they flew them in by helicopter or brought them in by truck or ambulance. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, you know, we just had appendicitis or something. Mm-hmm. We had the same wounds that everybody else did.
How did you react to that? Had you seen these types of wounds before in civilian life?
No, what I think the hardest part was that I had worked emergency room before, and I had done intensive care nursing, and the difference was that in the emergency room in the United States, if some kid came in and he had a head injury, he probably fell off his motorcycle and wasn't wearing a helmet, or some fellow came in with a heart attack, he was probably 50 pounds overweight, and, mm-hmm. you know, it all made sense, but over there, these were... The average age was between 18 and 22, perfectly healthy young men being blown up for what seemed like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like such a waste that by October, I was so filled with rage that our country would do this to these young men that I just had to shut down because you had to keep going.
Mm-hmm. What was your schedule like there at Third Field Hospital?
We worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. And we'd either do the day shift or the night shift. And it switched off and on. So, and if you needed it to stay longer, you did.
Yeah.
You nursed as long as they needed you.
What was it like being one of, you know, only 8,000 women or 9,000 women that served in Vietnam the whole time? Didn't mean to stump you.
No. I don't think, at least I didn't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just did my part. I felt like I was part of the Army, and the part that I did was the taking care of the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I didn't feel unusual. I think that Most of the patients that we had were quite surprised to see American nurses there. And they were pleased. I mean, this was like having their sister or their girlfriend or
sure.
somebody, and we would chat away with them if they were able to. But for me, it was just, I'm part of the team.
What was it like when you said that you shut down? What happened?
Well, when you became that angry, you also were not given time to grieve. I mean, we lost quite a few guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to, you had taken care of this fella for 3 days, 3 or 4 days, and you knew him. And all of a sudden, he's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't have time to process it at all because you had to keep going for the next guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so not being able to grieve and not being able to change what the Army and the government was doing, I couldn't stand being that angry or being that sad. So I just felt nothing. I just kept going.
You mentioned in your talk for the Fisher House that after a while you just said, I have to get out of here. And so you ended up transferring. Where did you go?
I went to 71st Evac Hospital in Pleiku. Now, why I thought that it would be better, I thought maybe just a change, mm-hmm. but I still worked intensive care there, and so we were still getting the same, you know, patients that we did before, except we had head injuries there, which mm-hmm. for me was one of, especially when I was in nursing school. It was one of the most depressing kinds of nursing to do, because your outcome, especially then, was not that hot.
Mm-hmm.
We did have a neurosurgeon at the 71st EVAC, and he did the best he could, but we would try and stabilize them, and we lost a few.
I know how powerful your story is and how emotion it can be. You had mentioned that you had taken care of many people with diseases, malaria and other unknown things that occurred over there.
Right, yeah. That was another thing that was kind of surprising and difficult. I can remember at Third Field Hospital, we had this young man come in, and they thought he had appendicitis. So they went in, and he didn't have appendicitis. So they closed him up. But he just kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what it was. And finally, he died. And we never knew what it was. But there were so many strange bugs over there and parasites that we had no idea what they were or how to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
That, again, it was that this young man being taken away for no reason other than he's in Vietnam. In Pleiku, we had a whole ward with really sick patients that had malaria. Now, a lot of them were fellows. We were given medication to take to prevent malaria,
but the
medication oftentimes made everybody sick,
mm-hmm.
and so the guys would not take them. And then they'd get malaria, and they would come in with these really high temperatures, and we'd have to get it down the best we could. And it was just some of them we lost because they were too sick.
You mentioned that you started looking upon all of your patients as your boys. Can you describe that?
They were really my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two younger brothers, and I could see all of these guys being my brothers. I think that was the hardest part, was when I first came into country, and I'd look at these young guys, and I'd think, that could be Tom, my brother. What a waste to throw away his joyfulness and his sense of humor and his enthusiasm, and for nothing. And for me, it was very difficult because they were my boys, and I wanted to take care of them, and I didn't feel that the Army was taking care of them the way I thought they should.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Army would value every single one of those guys. These are citizen soldiers. They aren't paid mercenaries. As we know, they weren't paid very much at all.
No, that's true.
Yep. And therefore, they should be treasured. Each one should be treasured. Mm-hmm. And yet it seemed as if they were just throwing them away.
You mentioned, again, in your talk about a young man who had been at least a double amputee, who you were, it kind of sealed your opinion of the whole war when he received a medal.
Oh, right. Yes. We had this one fellow. He was a big guy. I thought he probably had been a football player or something. And he came in. He was missing two legs and an arm, and he had a trach. And his eyes were covered. We weren't sure whether he was going to be able to see or not. And one morning I was working, and a colonel comes in, and he comes over to him, and he pins a Purple Heart on his hospital gown.
Hmm.
And it just took my breath away. I thought, is this an even trade? I couldn't believe it. It was things like that that you just... was so overwhelmingly strange that you just had to shut down. Otherwise, you would have been so angry. I don't think you're supposed to pop colonels in the nose for doing things.
No, although sometimes you did feel that way every once in a while.
Right.
But so you spent your entire year in Vietnam in these two places. What happened when you came back? How did it go when you reentered civilian life, or how did you reenter civilian life?
Well, one of the things the incoming nurses would tell us is as soon as you get off the plane in San Francisco or wherever you, you know, end up in the United States, take your uniform off. This is July of 1969. They said the welcome committee was not there for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
true.
That, yes. That we would not have been received well in our uniforms. And so when I arrived in San Francisco, I had an outfit packed, and I went into the ladies' room, and I took my fatigues and boots off, threw them in the trash, and put a dress on and went back to Minneapolis. I still had 6 months to go, but nobody ever knew that I was on that airplane, and nobody ever knew that I had been in Vietnam.
What did you tell your family and your friends? How did that work out?
Actually, I didn't tell them much, because how can you explain Vietnam?
Yeah, we've been trying to do that for 50 years.
Right. And an example would be, I was at work one time in this civilian hospital, and this patient said to me, "Oh, I heard you were in Vietnam. What was it like?" And I just had to turn around and walk out. There was no soundbite for that. There's no way you could explain what Vietnam was like. So you said nothing.
True, until recently.
Yep.
So tell me about how you came out, I guess, of the Vietnam closet and started talking about your experiences.
It all started with Diane Carlson Evans, who is founder of the Vietnam Women's Memorial. Mm-hmm. She was my hooch mate in Pleiku, and we were both Minnesotans, so we were pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been friends ever since. But she called me and said, "Oh, could you please help on the East Coast?" I said, "I don't know how you can talk about it, but not me." And it got closer and closer to the dedication of the memorial, and she called up and she said, "We really need people to speak about this, just to spread the word for the women."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, let me think about it." And in the meantime, my daughter called me, and she said she was going to Mount Holyoke, which is an all-women's college. And she said, "Mom, there's a guy here that teaches a class about Vietnam, and he starts his course by saying, 'You women will never know what it's like to be at war.'" She said, "I need you to come up and speak here." So she was taking a course on the 60s, and I said, "Well, if your professor says okay, then I will." And he said yes, and I went up there, and it was a life-changing event for me. My daughter introduced me, and she said, "I'd like you to introduce my mom, Edie Meeks. She was a nurse that served in Vietnam, and I'm so proud of her." And I'd never heard that from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, I got up and I said, "I'll tell you, I don't know about the history, the politics, but I'll tell you what it felt like to be a woman in Vietnam." And then I started talking about it. And after it was over, I went back to my hotel room and called Diane. And she said, "Edie, do you realize that we have known each other 23 years and we have never talked about Vietnam?"
I can relate to that with some friends of mine.
Yep.
Yep. That's hard. It's hard to bring up the conversation sometimes because you don't want to open doors or boxes or whatever, you know, the analogy might be that are in your head that you don't necessarily want to come out.
Right. And you don't know what will happen. I remember, and I've heard many vets say this, that I felt as if I started crying, I would never stop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with opening the little crack in the box. You don't know what's going to escape. And so for me, it was like putting your toe in the water and then pulling it out, putting it in a little bit more. I had to do it slowly because it was so overwhelming for me. The sadness was so huge. The grief was so huge that I had to take care of myself. And it was finally, there were two instances that really sent me to the VA, and one of them was when I did dedication. They asked me to give a speech at the dedication of the Huey helicopter down at the Smithsonian. And I said, okay. And so I went down there, but just hearing that Huey come down, go right across the mall over to the wall, and then flying back. And with the Huey, you always heard it first.
Right.
And that just triggered so many memories that I thought, I've got to go for help.
Well, I'm glad that they were able to help you. I'm thinking that the Vietnam Women's Memorial must have helped some, too.
Oh, heavens, yes. Going there for the dedication was like going to a country where everybody spoke your language, and you didn't have to explain anything to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a safe place to be. And just knowing that there were other women out there that had the same experience with no judgment, no nothing, just, yes, we understand, and holding hands together, it was so healing.
I think that was so important because in an article I was reading, you said that Diane was given such a hard time trying to get the memorial built.
Oh, my heavens, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was really kind of amazing. When you figure it took 3 years to get the money to build the wall, and it took 10 years to get the money to build the Women's Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And there were even a lot of veterans. The Vietnam veterans were really pretty good, you know, mm-hmm. and they took care of her. If she went to speak someplace, they would really stand with her. But there were a lot of other veterans that just didn't think that it was worth it. You know, why not have a statue for everybody? You know, she said, because I haven't served in every war. I've served in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. It was such an unusual experience for anyone. When I saw the women's memorial, it again, just like the wall itself, it just took my breath away. And you think about all the people that, you know, as a helicopter pilot myself, you know, I don't know the history of anybody that I ever dropped off at a hospital. But I was reading your story, and you had one you said that you did run into and had told you that he had returned and had a family and all these other things. And so that has to make you feel good.
Well, it was really kind of a relief. I met this fellow down at the Women's Memorial, and actually I don't think I took care of him, but he was at Third Field Hospital the same time I was. But he had a head injury, and I remember seeing him down at the Women's Memorial. He had a patch over one eye, and I went up to him and I said, you know, are you a Vietnam vet? Yes. And so we started chatting, and he said, well, where were you stationed? I said, Third Field. He said, I went through there to go to Japan. And I said, it's so wonderful to meet you because we never knew what happened to our patients.
Right.
And here was a patient who I thought, oh, he's got a head injury. He'll be a goner, you know. And there he was. He was fine. He had a lovely wife, 3 girls. Business of his own. He was from New Jersey, but we'll forgive him for that.
Hey. So am I. What is it with people from New Jersey? You know, sometimes we have this reputation out there somehow.
Well, especially if you're from New York like I am.
That's true. The idea of, you know, even if you weren't the one that helped him, that somebody dressed up like you did the same thing.
Yes, right. Yep. And that the outcomes were positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the thing that we never knew. The only patient I ever knew that we ever heard from, this was at Third Field Hospital, and it was a young man who had shrapnel had nicked his heart, and they opened him up right there, and they sewed up the little nick, and he was with us, I would say, probably 3 weeks before we sent him off to Japan. So we got to know him fairly well, and he sent us a letter and said, from Walter Reed, saying that he was doing just fine.
Oh, great. What a great story that is.
Yeah.
Wow. So let me, we have got 2 minutes left. You mentioned that you finally started going to the VA hospital. How did that go? Especially treating women. I guess that's the question that I have for you. Is it, how different is it?
I don't think they knew what to do with me. Because there weren't too many, women who had been in country, in a war zone. But the psychologist that I got, nice young man, really was willing to work to do everything. And we together figured out what PTSD in a female was. Mm-hmm. And he listened to me. He was open, you know, to what was going on and to what might help. And I think that for me, it was, where else am I going to go for help? I mean, I could go to any psychiatrist. If they hadn't been there, they'd have no idea what I was talking about.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the problems that you have when you go to a, quote, civilian psychologist.
Right. Whereas if you're at the VA, now they have lots of women's groups that meet, which is good. Because they used to have, when they first started treating PTSD, do we have to go?
Pretty soon, about 30 seconds.
Okay.
But anyway, Edie, I hope I can have you back on to finish the story and to get you on with some of the other people that were there at the Fisher House Stories of Service. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. And as I said at that ceremony out there, I said, I want to tell you again, welcome home.
Thank you. And if anybody's out there, get help.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. Edie Mix.
Okay.
Army
okay,
nurse,
bye.
Vietnam. Bye-bye. All right. Another program, we're done. We'll be coming back in next week and the following week, so stay tuned to Veterans Radio. Until then, you are dismissed.